Mark, thank you for emphasizing the result of these steps. That's how spiritual awakenings happen. I hear a lot of people read a result of these steps. No, it's the result of these steps, and thank you for emphasizing it. My name is Hal Marley. I'm a grateful alcoholic. And as some of you know, I try to live an attitude of gratitude because I got a long gratitude list. And this weekend, my gratitude cup runneth over because I'm back at Mount Eagle. Fred Adams and I were chatting up the day at noon. He said, "I know I've seen you somewhere. I can't remember where." I said, "Fred, I'll help you. 16 years ago, May 3rd, 1975, I was here doing the same thing I'm doing tonight." The chairman that evening was a gentleman named Jim Hawkins. Evidently, my message didn't impress Jim very much because it took him 16 years to invite me back. He said he's going to give me a second chance, so I'll try to do better tonight. As I stand here, I look around this room, I see the smiling face of a lot of old friends. I don't like to use that word old, really. It's older. Older is better than old. I'm getting old. I'm not getting old. I'm getting older. I like Johnny Carson's definition of age. Johnny says there are three ages: youth, middle age, and, gee, you look great. I've been getting a lot of those, gee, you look greats recently. Anyway, it's nice to see the face, smiling face of some older friends. But more important, it's wonderful to see the smiling face of a lot of brand new friends. Friends I never met till this weekend. Because, ladies and gentlemen, that's what A is all about as far as I'm concerned. Alcoholics Anonymous is over 2 million. 2 million by latest count. 2 million real good friends of mine, located in 136 countries around the world, the majority of whom I haven't met yet, but they are there. And what a warm, comforting feeling. What a security blanket. What peace of mind to know that I can walk into an AA meeting in 136 countries around the world tonight and find the same love and compassion and understanding I find in this room. Fantastic. What a fantastic organization we belong to. I am from Washington, D.C. Those of you who read the newspapers are probably aware that for the last 3 years, we've been known as the murder capital of the United States. So Washington's still a beautiful city, but it's a little sick on the inside, no matter what, sick, sick, sick. It reminds me of some drunks I've seen. They come to AA, and they take literally this, just don't drink and go to meetings. And they do. They stop drinking, they go to meetings, speaker meetings, and that's all they do. And they clean up. Some look pretty good. But inside, sick, sick, sick. Because they never got to the steps or the traditions or anything. And Washington's like that. Looks pretty good on the outside, but inside, sick, sick, sick. Now, in A, we don't point the finger. We don't criticize anybody or anything. So I will have nothing to say about why Washington is sick, sick, sick. However, I will make this statement, you who live in Atlanta. If the mayor of Atlanta had been on cocaine and booze for the last 12 years, Atlanta would probably be sick too. But let me give you the plus side. There's a lot of good AA in Washington. A lot of good AA. We have 187 meetings every day around the clock. Start at 6 in the morning till midnight in the greater Washington area. My home group is the Yays and Nays. We meet in the Capitol Tuesday morning at 7:45 a.m. The Capitol is closed to the public until 9 o'clock. But we are allowed to come in and have our A meeting. We had a visitor, some of you know, he's not anonymous like I am. He's used his full name in a Yale Hoffman from Denver. Yale's got 48 some years. At any rate, Yale came and visited us. Yale was mentioned the fact that 40 years ago I was a policeman up here on the Capitol force, right here in the Capitol. Said, our job is to keep drunks out of the Capitol. And now you got to be a drunk to get in the Capitol, is that what it is? Things change. For those of you who are unacquainted with Washington, the Capitol is that building with a big dome on top. And that's where we meet every Tuesday morning at 7:45. Well, I better get around to the subject of the evening, and the subject is alcohol. And a disease called alcoholism. Born and raised in the mountains of Carolina, my father was a practicing alcoholic, and my earliest memories, my father's fight against this booze. He was a druggist at a little drugstore. And I remember him coming home and telling mother he found some new medicine. It was helping him with his problem. And it would help him for a while. He'd be sober for a few weeks, then back in the bottle. I remember him disappearing. And mother would say, Dad had worked too hard. He had a little case of bad nerves. He'd gone away for a rest cure. I found out later it was the Keeley Institute in Greensboro, North Carolina, for alcoholics. And he'd come back from Keeley Institute, and he was cured sometime 1 or 2 months, but eventually back in the bottle. I remember our minister, Presbyterian minister, coming into our home, and he and mother and dad would kneel in prayer, asking God to help my dad with his fight against booze. And that didn't work either. I saw my father die, a practicing alcoholic, 43 years old. So I knew firsthand what booze could do. And I remember telling mother on the way home from my father's funeral, Mother, there's one thing you never have to worry about as far as I'm concerned, alcohol. I saw it kill my dad. And she didn't worry, and I didn't worry for a number of years. I was one of what I call a lucky alcoholic. I had many wonderful years of drinking. I worked my way through Columbia University in New York City with a dance orchestra. As you know, booze and the dance band business goes hand in hand. I had my first drink as a freshman at Columbia University in 1933. I was 18 years old, and for those of you who are slow on your maths, you can stop your adding and subtracting. I'll give you the answer, 76, so you don't have to add and subtract anymore. And booze became my good friend. Booze made good things better and better things best. Booze was the basic ingredient in gracious living. And it was a wonderful, wonderful way of life. There was an actress famous in those days, Mae West. You young kids don't know about her. Ask your mother and dad. They knew about her. Mae West had a one-liner that expressed my relationship with alcohol beautifully. May said, too much of a good thing is wonderful. And that's the way I felt about this booze. That's it. And I always said I was very fortunate. I had a dance band. Those days, there were a lot of cruises out of New York. This was before the airplane days, back in 33 through 39. All those cruises out of New York City, Labor Day, Thanksgiving, Christmas, New Year's, Washington's birthday, Easter, Memorial Day, all around. We took 26 cruises during my undergraduate career up there, 4 years. Went to Europe every summer on the boats, going over the big ships. Going over in June, back in September. We went to Soviet Union in 1935. Roosevelt, the President Roosevelt, recognized the Soviet Union in the fall of 34. And we were the first American dance band to play in the Soviet Union in 1935. And booze was my best friend. Booze never failed me. Booze lessened the pain of reality. And it worked. Unfortunately, I had a disease called alcoholism, latent at that time, but a disease called alcoholism, and it is progressive, and it did progress. I will jump over my good drinking days, because there were beautiful days there. 1955, 22 years after I started drinking, when it started catching up with me. I was an Air Force career officer, pilot, command pilot. Had the job as the air attaché in Warsaw, Poland, at the United States Embassy, on diplomatic status, living it up. Had the Air Force goes first class, you probably know, had a 16-room villa on the banks of the Vistula, 5 live-in servants, had the world by the tail. And everything was great. But suddenly I realized I had crossed that line from social drinking into addiction. I had to drink to live. I had to drink to function. Now, as I look back on it, I say I crossed the line there in Warsaw. Obviously, if it's hereditary, I was born with the gene. My father's an alcoholic. And there's evidence it is certainly a factor in this disease, hereditary factor. But I say I became an alcoholic in Warsaw because up until then I chose to drink in nice places with nice people. And occasionally I didn't have to drink. But I had a choice. And suddenly in Warsaw I realized I had lost my choice. I had to drink to live. I had to drink to function. I'd crossed that line. I'd become dependent upon alcohol. I'd become addicted to alcohol. And I had become an alcoholic. Warsaw was a hardship post, supposedly 2-year tour. Never had it so good in terms of material things before or since. So extended, stayed 3 years. Came back to the States in 58. My next assignment was to San Francisco, Hamilton Air Force Base. And here, well, I came to the Pentagon first, and here on a debriefing tour, had to face all those hot rock intelligence analysts, civilians from CIA and the State Department and the National Security Agency. These were all real sharp people. And they were asking me a lot of questions. I was supposed to be the expert on the Soviet Air Force in Poland and the Polish Air Force. Supposed to have all the answers after 3 years there. But for this alcoholic to have the answer, I had to have some booze inside of me. And there were 2 briefings in the morning, 2 in the afternoon, and I had to have that booze. I'd get up and have a couple of shots wherever it was in the morning, the BOQ or wherever I was staying, and take my attaché case. I had my booze in my attaché case. It was labeled top secret for obvious reasons. Get through the first ring. Excuse me, gentlemen, I have to go to the men's room. My attaché case has classified material. Must take it with me into the John. Glurp, glurp, back to the next briefing, and so forth throughout the day. Get back to the hotel or BOQ wherever I was staying that night. And face the cold, hard fact, I'd consume 1 bottle nipping out of that attaché case between briefings, plus the normal social cocktails at lunch and dinner. And this fantastic little computer we have between our brains, between our ears, went to work and went back 17 years to 1941. I was a second lieutenant in the Horse Cavalry, New York National Guard from New York City. We were at Fort Devens, Massachusetts, and we were federalized for 1 year, as all the guard units were in 1940. Fort Devens, Massachusetts is an old, old Army post. They had the regular officers' club for the regular Army down in the middle of the post, big old brick building. And they built for us, they expanded the post, and we had new temporary barracks down at the other end. We built our own officers' club down at our end. Bunch of real New York snobs, you don't want to go down there. Those Army types. At any rate, we had our own officers' club. We dressed for dinner every night, happy hour at 5:30. And on March 1st, 1941, one of our lieutenants brought in the Jack Alexander article in the Saturday Evening Post, March 1, 1941, and read excerpts to us over the bar during happy hour. And I remember our reaction, one of pity. Those poor alcoholics, my God, they can never drink again. They joined AA and they don't drink anymore, but my God, they can never drink again. To go through life without booze, my God, that's a fate worse than death. We felt so sorry for these poor alcoholics who could never drink again. And there it was 17 years later, and I remember that. I remember that article. I thought I remember that article said, these alcoholics, these AA members, had tried to stop drinking on their own. They couldn't. They'd gone to AA, and they'd been able to stop drinking. So my little alcoholic mind said, well, now, if you can stop drinking on your own, that proves you're not an alcoholic. 2 and 2 make 4. So I stopped drinking. I was drinking over a quart a day, just maintenance drinking. Wasn't getting drunk, just maintenance drinking. I stopped cold on May 1st, 1958. My next assignment, as I told you, was San Francisco. Beautiful, lovely San Francisco. And for 8 months, not a drop. Went back to the gymnasium, chasing a squash ball, lost 20 pounds of fat I'd picked up in Europe. Never felt better physically in my life. Went back to church. There'd been no open churches in Warsaw. Hadn't been to church in 3 years. Back to church, paying lip service. The office, the boss was saying nice things, occasional pat on the back. Things looked great on the outside, but inside, I was the most bored, resentful, sober person in the state of California. Bored to death. Hated everybody and everything. Visitors from the diplomatic colony in Europe we'd met over there would come through San Francisco, give them the quick tour up to the top of the Mart. There they were enjoying that beautiful San Francisco Bay Vista, and they had a glass of champagne or something. And there I was stuck with a Coca-Cola or a ginger ale, trying to be charming. And I hated those people. Saturday night at the big dance at the officers' club, everybody having fun, enjoying life, and I was on the wagon. But I stood it for 8 months. I proved that I wasn't an alcoholic, because alcoholics can't stop drinking. And I stopped cold for 8 months. As I look back on it, Monday morning quarterbacking is very simple. I couldn't figure it out at the time because booze had been my problem, I thought, but I'd stop drinking. Booze had been my problem, I'd stop drinking. I'd be well. I'd be happy again like I used to be, but I wasn't, so what the hell is it? I'd given up the booze. Alcohol was not my problem. What was my problem? Ladies and gentlemen, sobriety was my problem. Couldn't handle sobriety. And if you want a real, real lucid story about this, look at the last story in the third edition of the big book. Happened to be my sponsor, so I'm biased. He'll tell you all about how to handle sobriety, but that was my problem. See, I'd stopped drinking, so I'd proved I wasn't an alcoholic, but I didn't know that this was a threefold disease. Mental, physical, and spiritual. And on my own, still in the driver's seat, still running the show, I'd been able to handle the physical aspects of our disease. I'd stopped drinking. But on my own, still in the driver's seat, still running the show, I had not been able to cope with the mental and spiritual aspects of our disease. I'd stopped drinking, but that was all. I was dry, not sober. It was a life without meaning, without purpose, without direction. Sobriety without AA. It wasn't enough for me. But I stood it for 8 months. I proved that I wasn't an alcoholic. So I thought I'd go back. I couldn't stand that reality. Couldn't stand it. Had no tools. So I decided to go back to what had worked for all those years before. Pour a little booze on that reality. Booze lessens the pain of reality. And this was the fall of 58. I've been sober 8 months. And this was the time that the California wineries brought out Thunderbird. And Thunderbird, for those of you who don't know, Thunderbird is 25% volume. That's 50 proof. And I remember during this time, we had cocktails with my wife and a lot of entertaining. I'd always had booze around. When I wasn't drinking, I'd mix the drinks. And I grand announced one day, I was joining my guests. I had a little glass, wine glass of Thunderbird, just 2 ounces. Well, 2 or 3 days went by. That small 2 ounce had grown to a old-fashioned glass with a lump of ice and an old Thunderbird. Not long later, the double old-fashioned glass with 2 lumps of ice and the rest of it was Thunderbird. Sometime later, the ice disappeared, a double old-fashioned glass full of Thunderbird. And I think it was 2 months before I was drinking. I looked at one day, and I'd had a quart of Thunderbird while my guests were having their 2 martinis. And the next thing, of course, back in the bottle. And there I was drinking more than I had been when I went on the wagon 8 months previous, proving to me the progressiveness of this disease without realizing it. So back into the bottle. I stayed sober. No, excuse me. I kept on drinking for 3 or 4 years. 58, 59, 60. And the Air Force sent me back to get my jet ticket. Sober 6 weeks, back at Randolph to get jet qualified, because I knew if I didn't get jet qualified, I would get grounded, lose my flight pay, and that was very important. So I stayed sober 6 weeks at Randolph and got my jet ticket back to San Francisco, and I think I stayed sober 3 weeks after I got back before I analyzed. I could certainly fly those jets with more confidence, and I thought more precision with a few shots of booze under my belt. And within a week, drinking around the clock, just like had been the old days. One Sunday, I found a beautiful way to spend Sunday. Get my wife and daughter off to church where they belong. I'd call the flight line and get a little T-33, it's a single-engine jet trainer. Set up, go down the floor, have a couple of drinks at home while my wife and daughter go off to church to get well. Had to get well every morning. A couple of shots of booze, get well. Down to the flight line, little T-33. 35,000 feet over San Francisco Bay, that beautiful Sunday morning, and that's a beautiful area, those who know it. Get to 35,000, call in the tower, local clearance for 45 minutes. Turn on KABL, the San Francisco Good Music Station, on my radio. Pull back that oxygen mask, pull out that flask of Jack Daniel's Black Label sipping whiskey, and sip that whiskey and do lazy eights over San Francisco Bay. Now, ladies and gentlemen, that's a beautiful way to spend Sunday morning. And everything was great. My wife and daughter, they were in church where they belonged. God knew why I wasn't in the church. He knew I had to get my time in, flying time in. The Air Force was getting 45 minutes on Form 5. Everything was beautiful for 45 minutes. But then I ran out of booze, ran out of the jet fuel, and back to that damn reality. Back to reality. I came back to the East Coast in 61, had the best job there was in the Air Force for someone with my background, a member of the faculty at the National War College, the highest educational institution in the federal government. I was a faculty member, had a beautiful wife and daughter, had the world by the tail, and I drank it all away. General Butch Griswold, three-star Air Force general, was the commandant. He called me in one day and said, "Marley, drink a little too much. So you're doing your job, but you're setting a bad example for the students." And every day at lunch, we'd all go up to the officers' club for lunch in a little place called the tavern. And the faculty and the students all mixed, sitting, having lunch in the tavern. The Industrial War College right across the street, a lush I known over there, he and I would meet, and we'd go to the bar, which is right there in the same area. The students could see us, and we'd drink our lunch. My lunch was a Vodka Gibson's, four or five, while the students are by the fact having lunch. I didn't think anybody would bother to notice. Well, of course they did, and the word got out, drinks at every lunch every day. But I was still doing my job. I was ambulatory. I wasn't falling down or still introducing my speakers, doing my job on the faculty. But the boss called and said, "You're setting a bad example for the student." I cut that out. "Yes, sir." And I think I was sober two or three weeks, so it cut out anyway. Didn't drink at the club, but then back to the old thing. And 1 year later, General Butch called me and said, "I think the war college would get along pretty well without you." And he gave me a choice. I had evidence of me flying airplanes drunk out of Andrews while drinking, and they had evidence of me. They could smell it there drinking there, the faculty members token. So I had either choice of being court-martialed, lose my pension, or sign a voluntary retirement papers. So according to the record, I voluntarily retired from the Air Force for 30 years. So here it was, 1964, 49 years old, and everything I'd loved for, prayed for, worked for, 25 years of flying those airplanes around the world, gone. That wonderful life, as I already said, diplomatic status, all that stuff gone. Everything I just loved and worshipped. My life was over. Total chaos. Total chaos. I didn't know what to do, and let me jump ahead 10 years. There I was, just at the bottom of the barrel. I knew I could never again run around the world, no diplomats, none of that stuff, just beyond. All is through. Total chaos, total disaster. 10 years later, by the grace of God in this program, Dr. Kissinger, Secretary of State, appointed me a Foreign Service Officer, put me on diplomatic status. I was running around the world lecturing on alcoholism to the embassies all over the world. 10 years later, by the grace of God in this program. So miracles are still happening. Anyway, back to the dark days of 64. Here I was, kicked out, total chaos, didn't know what to do. I knew drinking had a little bit to do with it, but hell, I knew officers drank as much as I did. And they were still flying, still running around, living it up. Why did they pick on me? Well, what I need, I finally decided, is a good psychiatrist. A good psychiatrist could take me and put me on his couch, listen to my tale of woe, and he could do whatever a psychiatrist is supposed to do, wind that thing up and get it back on the track, and I'd be able to go back and drink the way I used to. So I went to see a psychiatrist, and by the grace of God, I picked a psychiatrist who knew something about alcoholism. Now, those of you around in those days, or even since those days, you've heard about these psychiatrists. As Dr. Peirce says, most of them look upon alcoholism as a Valium deficiency. And they do. They're still handing out those pills. At any rate, it was rampant in those days. Very few psychiatrists. But the psychiatrist I picked, or the good Lord picked for me, was a recent graduate of Columbia P&S, Columbia Physicians and Surgeons, the first medical college to send their students to Alcoholics Anonymous. Each student had to go for 12 meetings. And there was a course on alcoholism as a disease, the first medical school that taught it. And the guy I picked out was a graduate. He explained alcoholism to me. He explained that, well, I went to him. I said, Doc, I got a lot of problems. I told him, I'm going to be honest with you, tell you how much I drink and why I drank it and why I didn't drink. My wife didn't understand me. The Air Force didn't understand me. That's why I drank. I'm going to save you a lot of couch time, I told him. Tell him the truth. Anyway, he was a patient psychiatrist. He listened to my jazz for 30 days. Finally, he said, Hal, you're not psychotic. You're not crazy. You're an alcoholic. And I can't help you with your booze problem. I treat mental patients. Can't help you with a booze problem, but there's an organization called Alcoholics Anonymous. I suggest you go see them. November 17th, 1964, Lenox Hill Group, 2 East 90th Street in New York City, where I found this fantastic program. The first thing that happened in A for me was the miracle of happiness. So remember, I'd been sober 8 years, 6 years before in San Francisco. Walked into that A group, and I saw a bunch of people like I was, my age and younger, a few older, like a cocktail party, just living it up all over the place, having fun and enjoying life, and they weren't drinking. I thought about my days in San Francisco. I was sober and I was bored to death, the most unhappy, bored person in the state of California. And here are a bunch of people not drinking and happy. And I got a little hope. If they can be happy without drinking, maybe I can. I better do what they tell me. And that first meeting, a little hope, and every meeting thereafter, that hope turned to trust and faith. And every meeting I go to today, I get another layer of faith, another layer of trust. Here I look at, I'll never forget when I first, one of my first chit-chats with a temporary sponsor was, said, now in this program, you just have to have blind faith. I said, wait a minute, don't give me this blind faith crap. I'm a pragmatist, student of John Dewey. I want empirical proof. I said, okay, Buster, look around the A meeting, every A meeting you go to, look around this meeting and you'll see walking, living evidence. You will see empirical proof of the power of this program because you'll see a bunch of people who tried every possible way individually to stay sober and they couldn't. But here they are in a room, in an A room, and it applies right here. I'm sure collectively we tried every possible way there is to stay sober, but we couldn't. And here we are sober by some power, call it anything you want to. So every meeting I go to again, I get walking, living evidence of the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, another layer of faith. So here I was in the program of A in New York City, but I was a walking zombie those first few weeks, months. And in New York in those days, there's a beginner's meeting at 7:30 to 8:15. Then you go upstairs to the speaker meeting at 8:30, 2 meetings every night. 3 meetings a day was minimum, noonday meeting and these 2 at night. Every big group had the 2 meetings. So it was no big deal going to a lot of meetings. And a lot of meetings on the weekend at around the clock. At any rate, I'd go to the beginner's meeting, come around me. My name is Hal and I pass. I'm alcoholic and I pass. Wasn't grateful yet. And my sponsor said, look, you got to say something. I said, I don't have anything to say. Well, say it's a good day or it's a bad day or say something. This is a program of caring and sharing. You got to say something. Quit passing all the time. So I started trying to share. And I felt a little better. They were patting me on the back and saying I was doing all right. I was still in Air Force uniform. It took me 6 months to get out of the Air Force. They told me I was in the hospital at Long Beach, Long Island, the Navy hospital. And the psychiatrist there had told me, said, now we can, he knew I was in AA. He said, do you want to hurry this thing through? Or we can take our time with some blood tests. And you know, I was complaining about arthritis of this story, and I had other problems. And we've got to run a lot of tests so we can let this thing drift along. So please, keep that paycheck coming as long as you can. Because the day they discharged me, my pay stopped. So it was 6 months, and I had nothing to do but go to meetings around the clock. I had an automobile with me. I used to go to meetings all over Manhattan. Went to Jack Brennan's Cops and Robbers up there, north of the city. Went to the Sober Soaks, a midnight meeting out in Jersey, and all over the place. Total immersion, we called it, total immersion. But at first, those first few weeks or a couple months, wouldn't say anything. Finally got this, after you get this needle about sharing. I started sharing a little bit, and I gradually let these people know, okay, I'm a drunk just like you are, but I'm an uptown drunk. I'm not one of those refugees from the Bowery that we see coming in the program. I'm not one of those rejects from the Bellevue psych ward, the straitjacket department. They were coming in occasionally. I'm an uptown drunk. Now, I wasn't bragging. I was sharing. You understand this. But I just let them know discreetly, I thought, a little bit here and a little bit there. Let them know that, sure, I was a drunk, but I spent 9 years of my life at that college on Broadway, good old Columbia, 116th in Broadway. And Columbia had given me 4 degrees. And I wasn't bragging, I was sharing, you understand this. Let them know that I had Columbia 9 years there and they'd give me a bachelor's, 2 masters, and a doctorate. Just wanted to let them know they're getting a little class in their operation. I wasn't bragging, just sharing. One of the old-timers called me over after me. He said, Hal, said, we here in New York City, we get a lot of smart alecks like you. He used a different word, actually. And he said, we look upon you as one of two things. You're either an overeducated drunk or an intellectual idiot. So he took care of my 4 degrees from Columbia real quick. At any rate, program went along, still running around, making the meetings. Third step meeting one evening, and I was feeling much better now, and I was participating. Third step, oh yes, that's a great step, I told my 10 people sitting around the table. Yes, I'm following direction, doing just what you told me. Turn it over, let go, let God, so I don't drink, I go to meetings, and God, it's all yours. That was my interpretation of the third step. One of the old-timers called me out and said, Hal, you either misread or misunderstood the third step. It doesn't say turn your life over to God. It says turn your will and your life over to the care of God. So you seem to think all you have to do is stop drinking and go to meetings, and God's going to take care of everything. I said, no way, Buster. No way. I said, this is a program of action, and you are the action officer. And he quoted Bill Wilson, the big book, in the 12 and 12. Joy of living is a theme, and action is the key word. And he told me that this program is a program of change. I said, Hal, the man that you were will drink. You've got to change. You can't be the man that you were. The man that you were will drink. So I have to change that man, a program of change. And he reminded me that some of us change when we see the light, but most of us change when we feel the heat. I don't know about you, but I've known very few volunteers in Alcoholics Anonymous. As I told you, the Air Force supplied the heat for me, but very few volunteers in AA. At any rate, he kept on about this action. Action is the key word. And he quoted, he said, by the way now, if you read the book and you hear these old-timers quote about willingness, open-mindedness, and honesty, are the honesty, open-minded with the how of the program. And he quoted the big book. Somewhere it says, these are the essential elements of recovery, but they are indispensable. So don't confused about this willingness stuff. So now, willingness without action is fantasy. Again, emphasis on the action, action. And he said, I'm willing. I've stopped drinking. I go to meetings. He said, no, that's not enough. Willingness without action is fantasy. And he quoted chapter 5. You heard it tonight. Where it says, always throughout the book, willingness first, but followed by action. And there in chapter 5, says, if you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, there's the willingness first, but immediately followed by action. Then you are ready to take certain steps. Willingness first, immediately followed by action. And in step 8, made a list of all we'd earned and became willing to make amends. There's the willingness, but immediately made direct amends. The action following that willingness. And I got a real fine lecture on action, 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 program of action. I was the action officer. And being military, I knew what that meant. And he quoted the old famous line from Yogi Berra about action. Yogi, as you know, was the famous catcher with the famous New York Yankees. And Yogi had a lot of one-liners. I don't know whether he said them or not, but he gets credit for them. Yogi is known as a man of action on that diamond. And Yogi said, when you come to a fork in the road, take it. Action. 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 So I took another look at this third step, ladies and gentlemen, and what I decided to. This was a long time ago. I made that decision a long time ago, and every morning of my life I try to implement that decision. What I did was form a partnership with God. My senior partner, whom I choose to call God, a power greater than myself, call it what you may. Some people, Yahweh, Buddha, Mohammed, Jesus, call it what you A doesn't care what you call a higher power, as long as it's a higher power. At any rate, my higher power, whom I choose to call God, we formed a partnership. God's my senior partner, I'm the junior partner. As in all partnerships, the senior partner does the long-range planning, the brain work. I'm the junior partner. I get up and go out into the real world and do the things, mundane, day-to-day legwork I'm supposed to train for. And it's a close partnership. I know there are deadlines out there next week, next month, next year. It's a very close partnership. See, I don't have to go through any secretary or telephone to get to my senior partner. Available at all times, in all places, for whatever help, advice, support that I need. And I'm aware of these long-range plans. I know there are deadlines out there next week, next month, next year. But I'm not responsible for what goes on next week, next month, next year. My responsibility in implementing these long-range plans is one day at a time. And sometimes a day at a time is too much. 10 minutes at a time, or minutes, little hunks I can manage. And it's been a very close partnership. Because he told me from the start that it seemed that I had to remember that God would do nothing for me that I could do for myself. God did the impossible, but I have to do the possible. A program of action, 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 action. So I've made this partnership with God. As I said, I made that decision years ago, but I implement it every morning when I wake up. And it's been a good partnership, ladies and gentlemen. I suggest any newcomers, you're having trouble managing your life, look into this partnership with God concept. Understand there are a few partnerships still open, and the price is right. Good time to buy in. The market's going up again, so buy in now and it's great. there was a gentleman named Al Grau, God bless his soul, he was a Jesuit priest. And Al summed up this thing in partnership with God in 8 words, much better than I can. Al said, without God, I can't. Without me, he won't. Without God, I can't. Without me, he won't. And my sponsor warned me that even with all these things, prayer and turning my life over to God, there are going to be days, and he called them, we say bad days, he called them seemingly bad days, seemingly bad days. And I had to realize that these were the thorns of reality, and most of us have to face reality. This is no bed of roses, and he warned me that there would be these seemingly bad days where things didn't go my way. And sure enough, that's what days are, bad days, days when I don't get my way. And thank God I had a wonderful sponsor, Thomas Y. Lovren Jr., who some of you know, God bless his soul, Methodist minister. At any rate, Tom taught me a lot about this, those seemingly bad days, and he said, suggested that on these seemingly bad days where things seem to go not my way, sir, and I should stop whatever I'm doing and repeat this little psalm. From the Bible, 46 Psalm, 10th verse. So on these seemingly bad days where Murphy's Law is operating on all 12 cylinders, I just stop whatever I'm doing and repeat this little psalm. Be still and know that I am God. Be still and know that I am God. 46 Psalm, 10th verse. And that gives me, I can't say what it might give you, but it gives me puts me back in the proper frame of reference, back to acceptance, back on page 449, accepting the fact I am powerless over people, places, and things. And I'm not going to have my way. That my timetable and God's timetable are different. And I got along ago with God's timetable. So that's my new interpretation, or at that time, and I still live by it, of the third step. I want to jump over to recovery. I've already started about it, recovery, but drunkologues, they're okay, but I like to spend more time on recovery. So I said I came in the program in New York, and one of the first things they told me was to be a grateful alcoholic. Now, for the newcomer, when I say gratitude is the base of my program, for the newcomer, don't misunderstand me. The basis of my program is no booze, one day at a time. That our friend Sandy Beach says, the deep, dark secret of Alcoholics Anonymous, no booze, no booze. So that's the base of my program. For the newcomers, I don't drink a day at a time. However, I find, and most of us find, that sobriety is progressive, just like our disease is progressive. And some of us, at least I, by the grace of God, and only by the grace of God, that's the only explanation I have, was able to get a pretty good handle on this no booze a day at a time. Sort of get used to it after a while. And which allows me to channel my small talents in other pursuits. I've already got a handle on this, no booze, so what do I do with my talents? Devote them to other pursuits. And for me, being a grateful alcoholic. They told me if I saw a grateful alcoholic, I'd see a sober alcoholic. They told me that gratitude was the basic ingredient in humility. And humility was the basic ingredient in anonymity. And anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. They told me if I wanted the roses that came along with this program, I had to accept the thorns, because roses have thorns. As I mentioned before, there are thorns in my reality. I don't know about yours, but I have to face the thorns of reality. And living in Washington, D.C., as I've told you, there are plenty of thorns up there, believe me. any rate, I accept the thorns of reality. They make me appreciate those roses all the more. I've grown to be grateful for the thorns. They told me there was no law of physics. The two things cannot occupy the same place at the same time. Therefore, if I had a heart full of gratitude, there'd be no room in my heart or my life for anger and fear and guilt and remorse and self-pity and resentments and all those things that drive an alcoholic back into the bottle. Told me no matter how bad it got, no matter what they did to me, if I use the tools you've given me, the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the virtues that come from an attitude of gratitude, if I use these tools, in other words, if I face that individual or that situation with patience and tolerance and kindness and generosity and compassion and humility and love, the principles of Alcoholics Anonymous, the virtues that come from an attitude of gratitude. If I use these tools you've given me, I can happily accept any situation or any individual that comes down the pike. You've taught me that misery is optional. Misery is optional. Can't change reality, but it can change my attitude towards reality. And that's why I try to continue to be a grateful alcoholic. A few months later down the pike, my sponsor said, "Hal, where's your gratitude list?" I said, "My what?" He said, "Your gratitude list. You're just supposed to write out a list of things you're grateful for." I said, "Grateful? What have I got to be grateful for? I just got kicked out of the Air Force, unemployed, unemployable. I was wandering around New York with my resumes under my arm, going to the various airlines, trying to get a job as a pilot. I found that the airlines weren't too interested in hiring an ex-drunken Air Force piloto. In fact, they expressed no interest whatsoever in hiring an ex-drunken. So here I am, unemployed, unemployable, getting kicked out of the Air Force. What have I got to be grateful for?" I said, "You got a lot. I'll help you." I said, "Get out a paper and pencil. I'll dictate and you write." Got the paper and pencil. "Write down, Hal Marley, gratitude list." Okay. Number one, "You're grateful you're alive." Grateful I'm alive. Two, "You're grateful you're sober." Grateful I'm sober. Three, "You're grateful you're a member of Alcoholics Anonymous." Grateful a member of A. Four, "You're grateful for over 300 friends here in the immediate New York area you didn't know 3 months ago. 300 real close friends right here in the immediate area within blocks here in Manhattan. 300 good friends will do anything they can to help you stay sober. 300 new friends. Got a place to sleep tonight. Grateful you got a place to sleep. Grateful you got something to eat. Grateful you got something to eat. Grateful you got a job. Wait a minute, got kicked out of everything. Don't have a job. Grateful you don't have a job. Gives you more time to go to AA meetings." I still have my gratitude list, ladies and gentlemen. It's got longer and longer and longer over the years. And again, on these seemingly bad days, all I have to do is get out that gratitude list. Sure, there's some minuses in my life, but look at the pluses. Look at that gratitude list. My God. So a few more months passed. I said, "You know, it's no big deal sitting around these meetings saying my name is so-and-so and I'm a grateful alcoholic." I said, "Words are cheap. Words are cheap." I said, "Gratitude is an action word." Here goes that action again, boy. Action word. You got to live an attitude of gratitude. Well, my next question, how does one live an attitude of gratitude? Ladies and gentlemen, I wouldn't presume to tell you how to live an attitude of gratitude anymore. I'd tell you how to work the steps. It's an individual program. Easy does it, but do it. I will share with you in the remaining time I have about how I try a day at a time to live an attitude of gratitude. As I open my eyes this morning, as I do every morning of my life, no matter where I am physically, no matter what the weather is, no matter what my program for the day is, as soon as I wake up, as soon as I open my eyes, I crawl out of bed. Now, 16 years ago, I probably said I'd jump out of bed. I don't think I'd jump then. I know damn well I don't jump today. As soon as I open my eyes, I crawl out of the sack and get on my knees. Now, thank God for those three basics. Thank God I'm alive. Thank God I'm sober. And thank God I'm a member of AA. Because I figure with those three things going for me, I'm in pretty good shape. Not just to cope and put up with another day. I'm in pretty good shape to live and thoroughly enjoy another 24 hours of the AA way of life. Because that's what it is for me, ladies and gentlemen, a way of life. A is not something I joined, something I live a day at a time. So on my knees in the morning and on my knees at night, pretty simple way to let the good Lord know I'm grateful. What about 9 to 5? Out in that real world, that reality I had so much trouble with, that reality I had to pour the booze on to make it acceptable. I'm facing the same reality. As a matter of fact, you think about 1958, those of you who were alive in those days, when I was so couldn't stand reality, it wasn't bad. Gasoline was 25 cents a gallon. Eisenhower was president. There wasn't a war anywhere in the world. It was beautiful, really, compared to the reality of today. The world is all screwed up, as you know. But in 1958, I approached that reality in a critical, cynical, negative attitude, and it was horrible. Today I approach a horrible reality, but with a different attitude, with an attitude of gratitude. Now that makes all the difference. So, on my knees in the morning, my knees at night, and during the day, in order to accept this reality, I have resorted to prayer, ladies and gentlemen. Prayer. It's the 11th step, really. A daily interpretation, 11th step. Tom Lovern, God bless his soul, told me a lot about prayer. He's a Methodist minister. He referred me to Norman Vincent Peale's little tome on action prayers, thinking prayers, shooting prayers, all forms of prayer. And there's a little prayer that I've become taken with, or whatever you want to call it. Don't misunderstand me. The Serenity Prayer is still the standby. I mean, there are over 2 million people using it. It hadn't worn out yet, so stick by the Serenity Prayer. It's great. But I use this little prayer because it tells my story for me. It's January 12th, I think. My memory's shot. January 12th, I think, is the 24-hour book. Anyway, the prayer goes, I pray that I may be grateful for the things I have received and do not deserve. I pray that this gratitude will make me truly humble. That tells my story, ladies and gentlemen. Reminds me from whence I came. Reminds me that my sobriety is a gift from God. Undeserved gifts, a pure case of serendipity. And the second part about humility reminds me of the definition Tom gave me of humility many years ago. Tom said, humility is a recognition of the allness of God and the nothingness of self. Humility is a recognition of the allness of God and the nothingness of self. Of myself, I am nothing. Now, I was leading a meeting in Washington area some years ago, and the subject was a third step prayer. Relieve me of the bondage of self. I was quoting that. And in this thing, in my little opening remarks, I mentioned the fact that definition of humility. I had to kill self, and I had to remember the allness of God and the nothingness of self. Of myself, I am nothing. And one of my well-meaning friends said, Al, wait a minute. You go to a lot of meetings. You got a few 24 hours. You deserve a little credit. I said, no. Look at the record. And the record for me was 49 years of self running the show. 49 years. Self was in the driver's seat. Me, myself, and I. That was what ran my life, with occasional bottle of booze thrown in. And now, don't misunderstand me. There were some terrific years in those first 32 years when I was drinking, when self was running the show. But we pay off on end results. And the end result, after 32 years of self running the show, total disaster, kicked out of the Air Force, my career, my total life, shot. That was the end result when self ran the show. And that's what we pay off on, end results. So I came in this program, thanks to that psychiatrist, and turned my life over to power greater than myself, and things are entirely different. So the result for me was self had to be killed, had to be kicked out. And I mentioned one of my morning readings. I have 7 morning readings, meditation, whatever you want to call them. One of them is a God calling on May 3rd, Friday. One of my favorite readings. The title was Kill Self Now. And that beautiful reading explains about, we say we got to forgive someone, and I'm going to go forgive so-and-so. Well, the little book says, if I'm thinking about forgiving someone for what they did to me, I'm still concerned with self, because self's the only thing that's hurt. They picked on me, they picked on self. I've got to kill self, and I don't have any idea about forgiveness. They're gone. The thing that was hurt, self, is dead. So the point is, I got to kill self now. And I quoted this in the meeting I was in. That's one of my days. I've got to kill self every day. Kill self, kill self, kill self. Some young lady came in the meeting, sat down at the table. She missed the opening remarks, and she asked her seatmate, said, what's the subject? And her seatmate said, suicide. But that's what I have to do. That's what I have to do a day at a time, is commit suicide for the rest of my life, ladies and gentlemen. Keep that self killed. Another book. Now, I'm going to talk about another book. I just talked about God Calling book, another book. For the newcomer, I have a suggestion. Let me quote what Chuck Chamberlain told me and about 3,000 other people at the old Biltmore Hotel in Atlanta, Southeast Convention in 68, somewhere along there. Chuck told me and the other 3,000 people, said, everything you need to know is contained in the first 164 pages of the big book called Alcoholics Anonymous. Everything you need to know, according to Chuck, to solve any problem. He says, we put the plug in the jug, and that solves the booze problem. But as Chuck said, most of us, we solve the booze problem, but that doesn't solve our living problems. So we got to find a solution for our living problems. It's all contained in that first 164 pages of the big book called Alcoholics Anonymous. So for the newcomer, forget about God calling, and forget about the book I'm going to mention, The Practice of the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence. Forget about those entirely. You stick to that big book. Stick to that big book till we call what you read, when you reach to what, in Washington we call it the first level of sobriety, that first plateau of sobriety. I don't know what it is down here, but in Washington, you've reached that first level of sobriety when your sponsor lets you go to a meeting by yourself. Then, and only then, do I suggest you start reading this additional literature that we have, but the big book, it's all right there. Anyway, this other book I'm mentioning, I spent many years ago, a friend of mine, I was full-time at the State Department, so it was back in the 70s, says, got a hold of a book recently, Hal, I want you to read it. It was a book by Brother Lawrence. It's called The Practice of the Presence of God. And I was, said, what, is something new that Hazelden published? He said, No, nothing in Hazelden. This was written in 1666. Well, my immediate alcoholic mind said, my God, 1666, that's a long time ago. I'm sure the words are archaic. I'm sure the concepts of 1666 don't apply today. This is a different world. But I trust people. I trust this guy. I got a whole little paperback. The Practice of the Presence of God by Brother Lawrence. It was a series of letters he wrote and conversations he had with various friends. And on August 6, 1666, August 6 was the first conversation he had, the first letters in the book, first chapter, excuse me. And in this chapter, he was talking to a friend of his who wanted to find God. He was telling this friend, if you want to find God and get peace of mind, you have to take your material and spiritual life and completely abandon it to God. Your material life and your spiritual life, and completely abandon them to God. And he went on for the next three pages describing what we call the third step. But he wrote this on August 3rd, 1666. And Brother Lawrence talks about he was a dishwasher there in the monastery where it was. He was very bored and unhappy, washing dishes all the day in pots and pans. And he'd been enlightened, some one of his friends, one of the priests, about practicing the presence of God. He said, you know, I went in that place where I was doing my dishes and pots, and God was there with me. And suddenly, life took on a new meaning. I enjoyed shining those pots and pans. My God, look what a beautiful job I've been doing. And cleaning all the silver and the porcelain and all the dishes and cups and saucers. And I enjoyed my work because God was there with me. I was proud of the work I was doing for God. Then he got promoted to the leather work? Cobbler shop. And he was tick, 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 making the shoes, repairing shoes like that. And every little nail he put in there, just precise for the way it should be. Because God was with him, and he was proud of the work he did. And he found out by practicing the presence of God, his whole life changed. So, ladies and gentlemen, how do I live an attitude of gratitude? Through prayer. And I've found over the years that the level of my serenity, the level of my peace of mind on a daily basis is directly proportional to the conscious contacts I have with God throughout the day. On my knees in the morning, on my knees at night, we're doing out in the real world these action prayers, thinking prayers, shooting prayers, zapping a prayer as you walk down the street. You don't have to fold your hands all the time, at least I don't. So prayer, as I said, has become the basis of my daily life. And to sum it up, really, to simplify it a little more, trying to live by these spiritual principles that are in the 12 steps of this program. And I can't sum it up any better than Bill Wilson has summed it up in the preface to the 12 and 12, where Bill says the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous are a group of principles, spiritual in their nature, which, if practiced as a way of life, can expel the obsession to drink and enable the sufferer to become happily and usefully whole. And that's what you wonderful people in this fantastic program have given me, a happy, useful, whole life, restored to the human race and back in the mainstream, living, loving, and thoroughly enjoying another 24 hours of the AA way of life. I've run out of time, I've run out of things to say, but run out of time, and I'm one of those old conservatives, think meetings should be 1 hour, talk should be 1 hour. I was my first trip out to Texas, Harold Wilson, who many of you know, at Brownwood, said, Harold, how do you have meetings out here in Texas? They're 1 hour, an hour and a half, what are they? In New York, they're an hour and a half, they're around, you know, different. I said, oh, hell, out here, said, we start our meeting at 8:30, and we stop them at 9:30. Because we believe if they ain't bought it by 9:30, they ain't going to buy it tonight. So, ladies and gentlemen, the hour's passed. If you haven't bought it by now, you have to come back tomorrow night. Thank you all, and God bless you.